This lecture on non-radiometric evidence for the age of the Earth is presented by Dr. Robert C. Newman. Dr. Newman has a PhD in astrophysics from Cornell University, and he is currently professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary in Hatfield, Pennsylvania.
Basically, I've divided methods, scientific methods of estimating time periods in the past into two large categories, which call the first astronomical methods and the second geological methods, and then under geological methods, two subdivisions, non-radioactive methods and radioactive methods. This is done to deal with the presentation, which you are doubtless somewhat familiar with, of Whitcomb and Morris and members of Creation Research Society and such, who claim the basic evidence for old Earth, etc., is radioactive, and radioactive depends upon certain presuppositions which are not correct and therefore can be dispensed with. My contention here is that, in fact, our evidence for an old Earth, etc., depends upon a wide variety of evidences. All of them have presuppositions, no question about that. There are very few presuppositions that overlap, and they give very consistent results. And so we want to look at a number of these, and as we'll see, a number are not radioactive at all. I've divided up the astronomical methods into four methods, of which three of them are quite different than the radioactive methods. They would be light travel time, expansion of the universe, and stellar structure. The idea in light travel time is that we see objects out in space with our telescopes, with naked eye also, but not much. But with telescopes, you can see billions and billions of stars out there. You can see, in fact, that with your largest telescopes, that there are galaxies, collections of billions of stars, which lie beyond our own Milky Way galaxy. And we can observe in the laboratory and in our own solar system that light does not travel infinitely fast. When you look up at the sky and see a star, you do not see what that star looks like right now. You see what the light that left that star some time ago, what it tells you the star looked like when it left. So, for instance, our sun is about 8.5 light minutes away from us, which means the light we see from the sun on a clear day left the sun 8.5 minutes ago. The light that you would see from the planet Pluto, which you do not see, by the way, unless you've got a good telescope, left there about 6 hours ago. The light that you see in the nearest star beyond the sun would be Alpha Centauri, or one of its companions, actually, left there about 4 years ago. The light we see in the Andromeda galaxy, which is the biggest galaxy near us, and the one that is actually visible naked eye on a good clear night, if you know where to look, would appear to have left about 2 million years ago. So the light travel time argument is this. The universe must be older than the length of time it has been necessary for light to reach us from the most distant object we can observe. The universe must be older than the time it would take for light to reach us from the most distant object we actually observe. Now, there's some presuppositions there. There's a presupposition that light travels at a constant speed throughout history and throughout space. Not directly testable. We can test what light is doing around the planet Earth, and it's no particular, not at all clear why that should be different from where it is elsewhere. We can test what light is doing in our solar system, and we can find that evidences of it traveling at a certain speed, roughly 186,000 miles per second, are confirmed by repeated measurements of that sort. And our sun is traveling with its solar system through space, so we're moving into different areas of space as we go along, so that sort of thing. But I don't know of any direct way of checking beyond that. As far as I know, no proponents of a young Earth claim that light travels at different speeds somewhere else out in the universe, or has traveled different speeds in history. The usual way to handle this problem from young Earth's point of view is to claim either that that light never left those stars, that light was created on the way, so that all objects more than 10,000 light years away, we have never seen. We only see light that God created only 10,000 light years away from here, which is now reaching us. That has some rather serious epistemological problems with it, but otherwise is not attackable any more than the claim that the universe was created 2 seconds ago and you were created with all your memories. There's no methodological way to attack that. So basically, that's a situation with light travel time. We, of course, have to deal with the question of how you measure distances in space. Not an easy question, yet not a question that can be thrown out. It's quite clear when we measure average distances between stars in our own galaxy, and when we, which we can do quite directly, and then when we look at a galaxy like Andromeda and see what the average distances between its stars are, we can see that there's some sort of, that galaxy is a very definite long distance away, which is far more than 10,000 light years. We have a certain number of statistical methods of measuring distances to stars in our galaxy, which will work on other galaxies, which will work on stars in other galaxies. And these show us also that this Andromeda galaxy lies on the order of 1.5 to 2 million light years away. We can then begin to look out beyond Andromeda, and we see galaxies of the same structure, but in the telescopes they look smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. I suppose you can assume we're in a peculiar universe, which is only 10,000 light years out the edge, but the galaxies get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller as you get close to the edge, or that they're put up on the wall out there to look smaller and smaller. So that you can say, in fact, we're not looking way out. But they're rather ad hoc sort of explanations, difficult to deal with. The most distant object that we know of in the universe, well, let me work up to it. The nearest big galaxy seems to be 2 million light years away. 2 million light years away. Which would suggest that if that light came from the galaxy itself rather than being created on the way, that the universe is more than 2 million years old. The most distant known galaxy is 600 million light years away. 600 million light years away. And so if the distance measurements are correct on that, we are dealing with an age of 600 million years if the light was created, if the light came from the galaxy originally, rather than having been created on the way. The most distant known objects in the universe at the moment are two objects called quasars, quasi-stellar objects, which are about 10 billion light years away. About 10 billion light years away. That would then suggest, and that those are the most distant objects, so that actually brings us to the thrust of the argument, which is, if light has come to us from them, then the universe is at least 10 billion years old. Now, it's been suggested by a couple men in an article in the Creation Research Society, article in Science and Scripture, I believe it was, that the universe is a peculiar sort of place where light can get from one point to another in only 15 years, even though the universe itself is vast, that the physical space is not curved, but the space that light follows is curved in the universe. And so light follows a circle with a radius 5 light years, and therefore to travel halfway around a circle takes you pi times the radius, a little over 15 years. So that's been the claim that's been made. I've forgotten now, Harold Slusher, I think, is a fellow who had an article on this in Science and Scripture. And the real problem with this is to sit back and figure out what a universe would look like that has light with a radius of curvature like that. The best approximation I can give of what it would look like is it looks something like you standing between two clothing store mirrors. You've surely been in a clothing store where they've got these walk-in mirrors. You've got a mirror here, a mirror here, a mirror here, and you walk in here, and you look over there, and you see 5,000 of you, and you look over here, and you see 5,000 of you, something like that. That's basically what this universe would look like in such a situation. You would be in a situation where you'd have maybe 100 or so stars that are within 15 light years of you, and all you would see would be multiply reflected or curved images of these stars. Well, then you've got to get out your photographic plates and figure out how you get the Andromeda galaxy out of the nearest 100 stars, which are multiply reflected or with curved, the curvature of light making your images. And it really just seems to me you cannot do it. And I would be interested in seeing someone attempt to make that sort of construction. Onward and upward, downward, whatever. Letter B, expansion of the universe. Expansion of the universe. This is a trickier line of evidence. Basically, it operates in this way. We see that once you get beyond a couple nearby galaxies, the motion of the galaxies relative to each other is overcome by an expansion motion. The galaxies seem to be moving away from each other. So that if you were sitting on any given galaxy, we're only sitting in one, huh? You would see the other galaxies moving away from it. This effect gets bigger and bigger the further away you get. And so once you get beyond maybe the nearest dozen galaxies or so, all of the galaxies seem to be moving away. The closest galaxies may be rotating around your galaxy and look like they're moving toward you sometimes and such. But once you get beyond a couple of closest galaxies, all the other galaxies seem to be moving away from you. This is known as expansion of the universe. There are a few astronomers who dispute it, but it's been pretty well generally accepted. It's not like we can look in our telescopes and see the galaxies getting smaller, you know. They're not moving away that fast. You'd have to wait for millions of years to see them getting smaller. What you're actually observing is you're observing the shift in the frequency of the light coming from them. If you stood on a railroad track and seen a train coming towards you and listened to the horn, and then you stepped off, I trust, let the thing go by, and listen to its horn going away, you'll hear that the horn has a higher pitch as the train is coming towards you than when it's going away. Once in a while, when you're driving down the road, a car will beep its horn coming in the other lane just as it passes you. And you'll hear a very peculiar effect. The horn pitch will drop suddenly as it goes by. It goes bang, like that, as it goes by. That's the same thing. It's called a Doppler shift. Two moving objects, if you have a sound wave or light wave sent out from one, it will appear at a higher frequency to the observer if it's moving toward you, and a lower frequency if it's moving away. So we have, when we look at these galaxies, the frequency of the radiation from them is shifted downward into a redder color, called a red shift. And this gets stronger and stronger as you get further away, as you get out to the further galaxies. Some have suggested this is due to light getting, so to speak, tired as it travels and losing energy. And said red shift is due to that, and therefore there's no expansion in the universe. But that postulates a scientific law for which we have no other evidence, and therefore it's not usually been accepted. Usual explanation is those galaxies are actually moving away from us. It's the source of the redshift. If that is so, then, we find that if you trace the universe back in time, our expansion going forward in time, if you go backwards in time, would be a contraction then, huh? So if you go back 1,000 years ago, the galaxies would have been closer together than they are now. And 1,000 years before that, closer together than they are now. You find that if you go back somewhere between 15 and 20 billion years ago, all of the stuff would have been crammed into one very small location. You would have all this piled together. And it has then been suggested by most cosmologists that the universe is expanding from an explosion of some sort that took place somewhere between 15 and 20 billion years ago. The reason for that large variation in the number is the accuracy of this measurement. That's all the more accurately you can determine how fast this expansion is going, but that's the result you get. It's actually 17.7 billion plus or minus 3 billion, so roughly 15 to 20 billion years. So that would be the time elapsed since the Big Bang, if any such Big Bang occurred. Now, some people claim, not Christians, that no such Big Bang ever occurred because the universe is constantly having new matter created into it by a natural process as time goes on, and therefore that keeps the spaces uniformly filled. So as galaxies would normally be getting further apart, new material has come into existence in here and gradually forming new galaxies. So-called steady-state view of the universe. This has run into some very serious difficulties observationally, which I've not got time to go into. But the result has been that it was accepted at one time rather widely. It has been rejected because of these problems. A number of creationists have suggested there was no Big Bang, but the universe was created expanding just a few thousand years ago, young Earth men. And the fact that you can extrapolate it back into a very small thing is just accidental. Perhaps the same sort of thing as if you took a photograph of the shock wave expanding from a dynamite explosion. You could see the air, the shock wave moving in the air. You can see that under certain circumstances. And you would extrapolate it back to a point back in time. And they would say you're going too far. It extrapolates back into a dynamite stick, not into a point, you see. So the suggestion is you can't carry it back that far. Well, that's a reasonable sort of thing to say, except we have a problem that there is a type of radiation which can be observed in our universe which looks like it's the result of the explosion. is now a very low-frequency radiation that is observable only with radio telescopes. It's called the three-degree blackbody radiation. But it looks like, if you extrapolate back to the Big Bang, that it was a radiation from a violent explosion and would fit that sort of idea. Whereas if you extrapolate back 10,000 years, you only got something like 3.1 degree blackbody radiation or something, and you wonder where that came from and why it spread uniformly all over the universe, that sort of thing. So this radiation is explained by the Big Bang universe. It's not explained by the steady-state universe. It's not explained by young Earth universe. So much for letter B. Letter C, stellar structure. Stellar structure. This century, we've begun to find out something about what stars are. Not much known in the last century. I suppose it was known that the outer part was gaseous, that it was very hot. Nobody knew what the inner part was like. They supposed it might be iron or something like that. It seems to be in the inside of the Earth. Who knows? Nobody knew. In this century, it has been possible to do some very considerable work in the area of nuclear structure, the area of atomic energy, and to find out how to solve some very serious problems which existed in the last century that nobody knew how to solve. There was already good evidence in the last century that the universe was at least thousands of years old, and yet it was calculated that if it were made out of coal and burning, turning out the heat that it was turning out, that the sun would burn up in about 200 years. So it wasn't made out of coal, and so you had to postulate some very strong chemical reaction that could get you at least from a few hundred years to thousands of years. Well, in fact, there's a number of evidences in already from light travel time and such that you're not going to have to get up to thousands of years for the length of time it's going to take the sun to burn out, but up to billions of years. How do you do that? Nobody in the 19th century knew of any source of energy that would produce that kind of energy, that amount of energy out of that little bit of matter that you've got in the sun, you see. It's quite a bit, but I mean, for a chemical reaction, it's not going to be much to last that long of time. In this century, the nuclear reactions have been discovered. First one to be perfected in any way was the so-called fission reaction, which operates atomic bombs, where you break up uranium into two smaller pieces and you get a little energy out when it breaks up. But, yeah, well, it's little relative to the energy available in the two pieces. You get maybe a tenth of a percent or something of the total mass energy out of the reaction. Since then, another more violent reaction has been discovered, and that's the so-called hydrogen fusion reaction, where you take two hydrogen atoms and you put them together, opposite of the fission reaction, and you get energy out. Turns out for the light elements, you put them together, you get energy out. The heavy elements, you take them apart, you get energy out. The middle elements are stable. They don't have a tendency to break into pieces. They don't have a tendency to conglomerate into other pieces, conglomerate into bigger hunks. The hydrogen reaction, you get about 3% of the mass energy. Right, I may have misspoke myself. Roughly like that anyway. Larger amount. And with that, it was then calculated that the mass of the sun, if it is mostly hydrogen and helium, which is what it looks like from outside, would then last something like 10 billion years. And, so we're getting in through the cycle, something of that sort. Well then, on that view, on careful studies of the spectra that we can observe in the stars, the light coming from the stars, tell us about what elements are in the stars, the astronomers and astrophysicists begin to put together mathematical models for what stars are. It appears that they are masses of gas all the way through, top to bottom, all the way through, they're gas. The inside, of course, is very thick gas, a lot thicker than anything we have on Earth, but it's at very high temperature, and very high temperatures you can still remain gaseous. The inner part of this gas, then, is at such a high temperature that the reaction that goes on in a hydrogen bomb will actually occur. You have to get up about 10 million degrees to get such a reaction to occur. And the reaction does not blow the thing all apart because you've got such a high gravity, such a high gravitational attraction, such high pressure at the inside of the star that holds it together there. Obviously, it would not hold it together at the surface of the star, but the reaction is not going on there. It's not hot enough. Only a few thousand degrees there. So stars are very large balls of gas held together by their own gravity, and they keep pulling themselves together until the temperature gets so high inside that they set off this fusion reaction. When they set off that reaction, that produces so much energy, it raises the inside temperature of the star, and the star stops collapsing. Otherwise, it would continue to collapse gravitationally. And the mathematics have been worked out for stars, And it is possible then to estimate the ages of certain stars. We can estimate the age of our own star at around 5 billion years on this sort of a calculation. Without drawing a lot of pictures on the board, which I tried last time, you find that heavier stars burn their energy much more quickly. And therefore, once they have reached the place where the fusion reaction starts, they will only stay at that place in their life cycle for a short time. Some thousands of years, might be 50 or 100,000 years for the brightest stars we know of. Very small stars, much smaller than the sun, would remain using their energy in this way for a very long time because their mass is not as great, therefore they don't get as high temperature inside, therefore the reaction does not operate as rapidly, and they can burn their energy much less fuel. They can burn that fuel much more slowly in such a way as to last even a trillion years or so. So it's not estimated that that the universe is that old, or therefore that any of these stars burn up that much energy. Well, the result is then, when you do these mathematical calculations and set up on a chart what a group of stars ought to look like if a whole group started off at the same time, and where they ought to be located with regard to how much energy they're putting out here and to how hot they are on another diagram. You get a little diagram like this. It's just kind of packed. Well, you can in fact find then when you look at clusters, you do get distributions like that in star clusters within our galaxy. You get distributions like this. And you can then estimate their ages. And what we find out is that the oldest clusters in our galaxy are around 14 billion years old on this model. 14 billion years old. And that would then be assumed to be around the age of the galaxy. So it looks like the galaxy is a little younger than the universe, but the figures are kind of vague on the age of the universe. Our sun would appear then not to be a first-generation star in our galaxy, coming down about only about a third as old as the oldest star in our galaxy. And there is actually a composition evidence in favor of this also. Our star contains certain elements of the heavier sort that are not found in certain of the very old stars in our galaxy. Certain of the stars that show up to be, say, 8-10 billion years old, when you look at their spectra, you find they're missing a whole group of the heavy elements. They've got the light elements, they don't have the heavy elements. The more recent stars have got the heavy elements as well as the light elements. All of them have mostly hydrogen and helium. But the older stars seem not to have things like iron, lead, that sort of thing, which are observable in spectra otherwise. And this would suggest that something in the life process of the first generation stars is going to produce that sort of stuff. And then the later stars are actually made of, partially of material that was, thrown out of these stars by a previous, by an explosion of earlier stars. So, that's a rather complicated area which we're not going to have time to get into. Fourthly, letter D, meteorites. Meteorites actually bring us into a geological method of dating. So I'll have to discuss the method down further. But we're looking at minerals which don't come from the Earth. They come from out in the solar system. Most of them come from probably the asteroid belt, and collisions there have knocked the stuff loose. They wander into orbits that cross the Earth, and occasionally they cross the Earth's orbit. When the Earth is there, they run into the Earth. Meteorites, by using one of our decay methods below, the so-called rubidium-strontium method, which is Roman numeral 2, capital B2, by using that method, you can figure out the last time that a given meteorite was in a molten condition, the last time the minerals in that were melted. And the oldest such values you can get then for meteorites that have been found on Earth run 4.4 billion years, which suggests that they were in a melted state sometime at that point. Obviously, the surface of these things melts when they come into our atmosphere, but large meteorites do not melt inside. It's very easy to show that from just tracing in the nature of the mineral. You can see the outer small outer skin that has been melted as it came in. So getting times for 4.4 billion years suggests then that something connected with the origin of the solar system occurred roughly 4.5 billion years ago. So that's the result obtained from meteorites. This has been a very quick sketch, but it'll give us a little more time to look at these other areas. Let me turn to Roman numeral 2, geological methods. geological methods. A little out of my area, but I have a friend who was teaching until recently out at Grace College in Indiana, a biologist who was concerned about this whole matter and decided he would work through the geological literature and see what kind of materials there were for the age of the Earth that did not depend upon radioactive decay. And he's worked up a very nice paper. It's marked on the second page there, Wonderly, Daniel E. Wonderly, some types of non-radiometric data, which can be used in relation to the problem of age. Article is to appear in the Journal of American Scientific Affiliation. He has, I think, 18 different examples of types of data which give us suggestions about the age of the Earth that do not have anything to do with radioactivity. And what we want to look at is a few of these examples that are more easily understandable than others. First one I want to look at, I have listed number one. These are all under capital A, non-radioactive evidences. Number one, evaporite layering. Evaporite layering. That doesn't make too much sense. Let's read the section, and I'll have to explain a few things here as we go along. Multi-layered deposits are found of two water-soluble types of salts, which will be deposited when water is evaporated away. If you take a pan of water and put it on the stove with certain salts in it, get them salts mixed up good, you boil away the water, you'll find that as you boil away a certain amount of the water, you'll begin to get a white film on the bottom of the pan. Because when you get a certain amount of the water reduced, you have raised the percentage salinity of the solution up so high that the stuff will not stay in solution anymore and will begin to drop out in size. And then you boil some more away, you may get another type of salt to come out of the solution. And you boil some more away, you may get another type of salt. If you've got three or four different salts you put in the solution, you see. They fall out when the percentage has gone down to certain values of the original amount. Well, there are found deposits, multi-layered deposits, of two of these sorts of evaporates. One of them is called anhydrite, which is just calcium sulfate, and the other is what we call table salt, sodium chloride. Multi-layered deposits are found of these two evaporates, which not only alternate with each other, but also alternate with relatively insoluble calcium carbonate layers. So two salts that are very soluble in water and one salt that is not very soluble in water are found to alternate with one another in mineral beds in the earth, near the surface of the earth. The Castile Formation in West Texas and southeastern New Mexico is one such deposit, the thickness being in excess of 2,000 feet in some places, including approximately 200,000 layers of pairs, calcium carbonate, insoluble, and anhydrite, calcium sulfate, soluble. So you've got here a formation about 2,000 feet thick, 200,000 layers. That's 100 layers per foot. So you're talking about layers a tenth of an inch thick. 200 layers per foot for 2,000 feet of calcium sulfate and calcium carbonate. The one does not dissolve easily in water, and therefore when water begins to evaporate, it comes out very quickly. The other does dissolve well in water, and therefore water can be very nearly evaporated before that will be deposited. You've got 200,000 of these layers. The nature of these thin layers of anhydrite and calcium carbonate definitely shows that they were deposited by precipitation. They were deposited by being precipitated out of the liquid, which are located. Does not mean by precipitation that they came down in a thunderstorm, but the chemical use of the term precipitation. They're very thin layers. They follow each other in their shape, and yet they're undisturbed over large areas. Suggests they were deposited by precipitation rather than by tidal waves, which is hard to see how we'll deposit such salt layers anyway. It should be remembered that the two substances do not precipitate at the same degree of concentration of the seawater. calcium carbonate begins to precipitate when seawater has been evaporated to about half its original volume. You take regular seawater and you start evaporating it. When about half of it is gone, the calcium carbonate, which is rather insoluble, will begin to precipitate out. But the anhydrite, which is relatively soluble, it will not begin to precipitate out until about 80% of the seawater has been evaporated. But you've got alternating layers, 200,000 alternating layers of this stuff. What does that suggest? It suggests that there's been a small lake or sea in there that has evaporated from 100% down to below 20% 200,000 times in the course of geologic history, just to make that one formation. Now, that is very hard to reconcile with a one-year flood laying down geologic formations. You've then got to figure out some process that's going to quickly evaporate a large lake 200,000 times in 1 year. That is almost 1,000 times a day, about 600 times a day. But it's got to evaporate it under a sufficiently quiescent circumstance that you form thin layers which are not disturbed. Then this stuff would be mucked up rather badly by tidal waves. It's got to be something that has had no tidal waves sloshing over during that period. If you're aware of Whitcomb Morris's flood geology, tidal waves form a very big part of trying to get the various sediments laid down. The aerial extent of these layers, the area they cover, is many square miles, with almost uniform thickness of any given layer maintained at least over a distance of 18 miles. He then gives a couple other examples of other evaporite formations in that one. That one we mentioned is a castile formation, West Texas and southeastern New Mexico. That is evaporite layering. Number two is a somewhat similar situation, but has nothing to do with evaporation. Sandstone shale layering. Sandstone shale layering. Sandstone is a stone made of cementation of particles of sand. Shale is a stone made of cementation of particles of very fine silt, much smaller particles than sand. Maybe identical kind of rock as formed sand, but the size of the particle is hundreds of times smaller than sand. Now, flowing water will deposit big rocks if it's flowing only a few miles an hour. When it's flowing perhaps a half a mile an hour or so, it will deposit sand. But to deposit silt out of water, the water has to be quite still, and you have to wait for hours. Anybody who's tried to get water out of a muddy pond to drink would be aware of this. You have to take the stuff and you sit it somewhere for 24 hours or so, and then a lot of the silt settles out, and you can skim off relatively clear water at the top and then boil that or something to drink. So you have the situation that very slow settling for fine clay particles, silt particles, a rather fast settling for sand particles. Multi-layered deposits of sandstone and shale are found in the Hayman Formation in the Marathon region of Texas. Here there are approximately 15,000 thin sandstone layers alternating with approximately the same number of contrasting shale layers in this formation. The study of such a deposit requires that we carefully consider the length of time required for the clay particles, which formed each layer of shale, to settle out of suspension. The clay particles which form uniform layers such as this are extremely small, thus settling slowly, and only when a minimum of turbulence exists. You've got to have long, quiet periods of time for the clay to settle out. You don't have quiet periods of time with tidal waves. You've got to get 15,000 layers settled out in a very small fraction of a year because there's all sorts of rock formation under this you're going to have to deal with. So again, it seems to suggest maybe 15,000 times when the river was flowing very slowly, when it would let out clay, and 15,000 times when it was flowing rather rapidly, when it would let out sand, which sounds like some kind of seasonal variation of river flow, just as the evaporation in the previous thing would probably sound like seasonal evaporation of a lake, a little lake that dries up during drought periods or something of that sort. Yet you've got to deal with 200,000 layers in the one case, and in the other case, 15,000 layers. Thirdly, coral reefs. Coral reefs. A third line of evidence, then, is the thickness of modern coral reefs as related to the growth rates of reef-forming organisms. Bad tongue twister. The thickness of modern coral reefs as related to the growth rates of reef-forming organisms. What are coral reefs? They are formations made up of coral, and coral is not just a rock. Coral is a remains of a type of an animal that builds these kind of a calcium skeletons, if you like. They're skeletons in a kind of a broad sense around the outside of themselves. They grow only beneath water. They're a water animal, if you want to call them an animal. Yeah, we call them an animal. They only grow in a layer where there is food available, and the kind of food they eat has got to be near enough the top of the water that it can get light. So it turns out that coral only grows below the level of the water, but no more than 100 feet below the level of the water in normal seawater, where you've got a pretty clear situation. Light gets down a good ways. But by the time you've gotten down 100 feet, you're getting too far down for them to get the kind of food that they've got to have. So coral grows top 100 feet of seawater. It's got to be the right temperature and a couple other complications of that sort, which affect the growth rate. The thickness of modern coral reefs, then, as related to the growth rates of reef-forming organisms. The thickest deposit of this kind measured to date is that of Eniwetok Atoll. Eniwetok Atoll. That's where they set off one of the hydrogen bombs. And while in order to do that, they made some core samples and various other things so that they could tell what the destruction would be later. Actually, most of the top of the atoll was wiped out. But they drilled core samples to see how far the coral went down such. A test drill penetrated 4,610 feet of coral deposit in order to reach the volcanic seamount on which the coral was built. So you've got almost a mile of coral straight down before they reached the rock. A study of such deposits in the light of present-day coral growth rates cannot produce an exact chronology of the past, obviously, but will nevertheless be very meaningful. You can work the fastest growth rates that you know of for coral at present time, or you can also work the rates at which coral normally grows at this sort of thing. Now, you've got some complications here. The stuff that's 4,600 feet under couldn't have been 4,600 feet under when it originally grew. It had to be within 100 feet of the top of water. So you've got a situation where either the mountain on which the coral was sitting sunk or the sea rose. Doesn't make a difference which, but one of the two had to have happened. And so that will affect you actually what's going to produce your chronology is how fast the sea went up or the water thing went down. However, it did not go down too fast. If it goes down too fast, no coral will be able to keep growing on top. Won't be able to keep up. In other words, if the mountain gets 200 feet below before the coral grows up 100 to get up within 100 feet of top, you're stuck. The coral that's now 4,006 feet, 100 feet, is long dead. But yet remains or doesn't decay too easily in the sense of the stuff falling apart, so others can grow on it. But that's going to complicate your growth rate. But using the present-day growth rates, you can make some estimates. According to detailed and extensive studies by A.G. Mayer on the growth rates of various genera of corals in the Samoan Islands, tropical area where conditions are most favorable for rapid growth, the fastest rate of upward growth of the reef surfaces was only about 8 millimeters per year. 8 millimeters per year. Now, if you make a quick calculation, you may do it in your head, but I've already done it on paper. 8 millimeters a year is about 1 inch in 3 years. That's about 1 foot in 36 years. That's about 3 feet per century. About 3 feet per century. So you divide 4,610 feet by 3, and you get the number of centuries that it would take at the fastest rates for coral reef growth known today, it would take you 1,537 centuries to grow this one reef, which is 153,700 years. So based on present fastest rates of coral reef growth, it would take you 153,700 years to grow the Eniwetok Atoll. You have to have considerable cooperation of the ocean settling at the right speed. It settles too fast, it stops the coral growth, and you just have a sunken reef, and it doesn't reach the surface, as Eniwetok does. If you don't settle fast enough, it can't grow that fast because it can't grow out of water. It can't come up above the surface, you see. Mr. Conway.
Is there any reason to believe that before the curse on the earth that the growth rates, you know, in these ideal conditions would have been similar to any good reason to believe it would be similar?
No way to know, but that means you're going to have to make a great deal of the geologic column then to be pre-Adamic fall, not flood, not Genesis flood. So that's going to put you in quite a different situation. And in any case, one would not suppose that you're going to have 4,000 feet of it grown in 6 days, if you imagine the fall occurred within a few weeks or so of the original situation. So yeah, if you go into a gap theory where you have ages before Adam, you got no troubles. Not this trouble anyway. Here we're trying to show troubles with a view that the earth and the universe are only a week older than man, and he is only a few thousand years old. Here you definitely have troubles. You've only got a few weeks before the fall, under most people's understanding, and not over 900 and some years in any case, because that's the age of Adam when he dies. And he's got to have a number of children who are hundreds of years older than that and who were born after the flood, after fall, excuse me, that sort of thing. So you really can only have about 100 years at most for, in fact, he says, what's 100 and how many years to the birth of Seth? 130? And that's after the fall. So because the other two guys have already been killed, one's killed the other. So, you've only got 100 or so years between the creation and the fall at most. And you're really going to have to do something with the growth rates then and the sea rising rates and things of that sort. For a gap view, no great problem. For some kind of a day-age view, no great problem. For a young Earth view, a very serious problem. That was coral reefs. Number four, multiple fossil forests. Another line of evidence is the multiple forest deposits in Yellowstone National Park. You have a formation in Yellowstone National Park where you have 27 forests on top of each other, like this, going up through the column, of large trees close relative of our redwoods. The average sort of age of mature trees in these forests, by counting tree rings, is 500 years. Each of the forests was destroyed by a volcanic outburst of some sort. There's volcanic ash around the trunks of the trees. The trees are yet still standing up, though, up to where they got burnt off, presumably by the volcanic activity. In other words, the ash came down and protected the lower part of the tree, but then the top part was burnt off or rotted off of that sort by the situation. And then you have the ground gradually becomes fertile again, and a new forest starts. And you've got trees 500 years old in that forest, some up to 1,000 in some of the forests. Then you've got that burn off, you've got that wiped out by volcanism, and another forest grows up. Another 27 such forests stacked up. Studies in Mexico around some recent volcanoes suggests it takes about 200 years for an ash fall to be reduced by various microorganisms to the shape where it will support large trees again. You know, get to a shape where trees of this sort will grow on it again. When a volcanic deposit is given, that kind of ruins the fertility for a while, and then it will recover enough debris and microorganisms and such working on it over a period of time. So suggestion, for each forest we take about 500 years for the mature trees to grow and about 200 years for a new forest to start after the previous one had been wiped out by the thing. We do not, of course, know in any case that we're looking at first generation trees in each forest, but this is kind of a minimum then. 500 for each forest, 200 for each tree, for the space between. We have then 700 years per cycle. 700 years per forest cycle, and we have 27 cycles. You come out for 18,900 years for this one formation in Yellowstone. Yet it's not—it's certainly not the whole situation by any means. And again, runs you into some very serious problems with this situation. Wickham and Morris says, wonderly, Wickham and Morris have tried to explain these forest deposits by saying that the trees were floated into place during the flood, forming a semblance of successive forests preserved in volcanic ash. But the problem here is that the forests are actually still, trees still stand, and they're rooted, and that sort of thing. They look like they grew in that spot. So this is a very serious problem. A section of material I overlooked, by the way, regarding the coral reefs and regarding similar sorts of marine reefs is the existence of very fragile skeletons still preserved in them, which suggests the stuff was not rolled in by tidal waves, something of that sort, which I've not got time to discuss in any detail here. Number five, seafloor spreading. This will be the last one we'll get a chance to cover. But these are areas which I think do not get into the problems that radioactive decay is thought to get into, and yet show an old Earth. The last one, seafloor spreading. Wonderly says, the present and past rates of seafloor spreading, as exhibited in the oceanic ridges, where you see material coming up from inside the Earth and forming new seafloor and gradually pushing aside what was already there. So you get a pushing apart of the, say, the Atlantic floor right in the middle. The Atlantic Ocean is a ridge running down where new material is coming out, and it's gradually pushing continents apart then. The present and past rates of seafloor spreading is exhibited in the oceanic ridges, and the thicknesses of sediments which lie upon the ocean floor at various distances from this present middle line of the ridges are evidence of old Earth. The present rate of seafloor spreading along the mid-Atlantic ridge is estimated to be only a few centimeters per year. So the this material is moving apart at a few centimeters a year. The fact that the sediments are thin near the center line of the ridge and become gradually thicker farther away from the ridge on each side is an indication that the spreading has been practically continuous and gradual for a long period of time. Here you've got new stuff coming up in the middle of the Atlantic and pushing apart. And as you look at the sediments on top of the ocean crust, you find they're very thin at the middle. They gradually get thicker as you go away from this ridge. We're still not talking about anywhere near the continents. We're not talking about 10 miles off the continents where the Hudson River is dumping sediments on the ocean floor. We're talking about 100 miles from the mid-Atlantic ridge, which is 500 miles, say, from either continent. So the fact that these become gradually thicker as you get away from the ridge is an indication that the spreading has been practically continuous and gradual over a long period of time. Also, the linear strips of igneous rock, which lie along the west of the ridge, are practically identical to the linear strips on the east side of the ridge. So if you look at the mid-Atlantic ridge like this going down the center of the ocean, you'll find that there are strips of igneous rock here and here. And then another pair out here, et cetera. I'm just going to draw a short sketch of it like this. And what we find is when we look at the magnetic characteristic of these rocks, when we look at the magnetism, we'll find these are slightly magnetized. We'll see the magnetism is not the same direction in all of them. But sometimes it points kind of northish, and sometimes it points south. Sometimes north, sometimes south. We find that also it says the linear strips of igneous rocks which lie to the west of the ridge are practically identical to the linear strips extending on the, along the east side. Thus, one side forms a mirror image of the other with respect to the chemical and magnetic nature of the parallel trends of igneous rock. So the magnetism is aligned on strips. The first strip on either side, same magnetic alignment. The second strip on either side may have a different alignment from the first, but it's the same for the two in the second position. The third, different from the others in between them, but agreement, etc. You're getting a mirror image pattern going away, both chemically and magnetically. This gives us much reason to believe that each pair of corresponding strips was formed at approximately the same time from the same mass of magma along the ridge, and that the slow spreading of the floor at the rift has resulted in their now being widely separated. The above-mentioned symmetry along the mid-Atlantic ridge has been carefully mapped, and the two sides correlated for a distance of about 125 miles out from the center of the ridge. Now, if the things are moving apart at a few centimeters a year, that would be a few meters per century. a few kilometers per 100,000 years. And 125 years is a few hundred kilometers. You're talking about 10 million years. And to get the spread of the of South America from Africa that you've got, you're talking about 1,000 kilometers, which is about 100 million years. And so you get this sort of situation. Radioactive methods of checking dating in rocks also correlate with this, give the same sort of ages for these particular rocks. Got to quit there. Didn't have a chance to discuss the... Thank you.
If you have questions, you'll have to follow up personally with Dr. Miller.
Concerning this first one, the fourth day, you know, it says that God made the lights, that they were the signs. If it took billions of years for the light to reach the earth, how would there be signs that?
I would understand there would be signs to mark off the days from the nights, the seasons from each other, which is what the account says.
But they couldn't have been signs if they made them, and then it took billions of years for the light to reach the earth. No one would have known they were out there.
My suggestion is they were out there until they appear in the fourth day of time. That the statement there is not the original creation of material, but it's a clearance of the atmosphere so that they can become seen. So that you can now tell that it's the earth, that it's the sun that's responsible for day night. You've had day night before that time. It's the same length of day nights. Apparently, the right kind of light to grow plants and stuff. So the assumption would be that not that God takes away some light, puts another light. Never says anything about that in the account. He just says, now let the sun, etc., appear in the heavens to mark off the day from the night, the seasons, the years, etc., which they do. The sun and the stars together mark off months, years, and things of that sort. So my suggestion is that they appear there because the sky is cleared at that point. At that point, there have been clouds before that completely mask out our seeing of things. They clear at that point, and they're now able to mark the day. You see it day-night, but you didn't see why. Now you see the sun sets today. You see the months now because you can see the moon relative to the sun, and that actually marks months. And real meaning of what months is. I mean, we've got stylized months that have nothing to do with the moon. But the ancient use of months and the whole derivation of the idea of months is based on the moon. So, and the whole Old Testament use of it is based on new moons instead of current. So I would say signs in that sense. They are signs to mark off the day and night, not signs in the sense of a prophet saying, what sign shall I give you that something shall happen? But signs mark off.
As far as the speed of light, what about the fact that, and maybe this is another thing that I'm wrong, but that quasars pulsate? And that they
pulsars pulsate, not quasars.
Okay, pulsars.
Different, whole different class of objects.
Okay. But the point is that they may be, what, millions of light years across? Hundreds of thousands of light years across?
No, pulsars are felt to be probably 10 miles across.
Oh, okay.
Quasars are in a whole, see, quasars and pulsars have nothing to do with each other.
Okay.
Pulsars are probably the remnants of supernovas, and they are very small, collapsed stars. Quasars are probably galaxies. Quasars are probably galaxies. So,
okay, so then light is not constant across them.
No.
Okay. What's your suggestion? Since carbon-14 seems to be the one that's most often under attack,
yeah.
What's your understanding of its validity?
Well, I think you have to, for reasonably accurate material, you've got to have some other correlation with it. They've used tree ring chronology back about 5,000-6,000 years now as a correlation against it to check it. Basically, the problem there is that carbon-14 is produced by cosmic rays coming in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And the cosmic ray production will vary depending on where the cosmic rays come from. Most of them probably from the sun, some of them from the sun. They will depend upon the magnetic field of the earth and the shape of the cosmic rays, things of that sort. So there's good evidence that, in fact, the rate has not been constant as we ignite.
This has been a presentation of IBRI, the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute. IBRI is a group of like-minded Christians who see a desperate need for men and women who are persuaded of the complete reliability of the Bible to get training both in biblical studies and some other academic discipline, and to use this training both to help other Christians deal with many areas where non-Christian teaching is so dominant today, and also to remove many stumbling blocks that have kept others from the gospel. Such help is given through a continuing series of seminars, through IBRI's free catalog of literature and cassettes, and through lectures and slide talks that can be given by members of IBRI at your location. For more information or a free copy of our catalog, please write to IBRI, Post Office Box 145, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.